host for PUFO Paranormal and UFO Radio. Today we have Bill Kennedy back. He's been here before, and everyone just loved him. And he has a book out called The Lucifer's Lodge. It's on church, it's on the satanic ritual abuse in the Catholic Church. Now, as everyone knows, I've been doing some research on possible Satanism in Wisconsin. So the today, Bill had contacted me via email, and I says, Bill, I says, I need your help. I says, you've got the contacts, you know the people. Will you help us with this, trying to get the lowdown of Satanism in southeastern Wisconsin? And he jumped right on it, and he's been working on it this afternoon. And he's just called me now to give us information that he has on Satanism and directing it here in this area. And then we're going to follow it on with various shows, other upcoming shows of Satanism in other states besides. But tonight's focus will be Wisconsin. And hello, Bill Kennedy. How are you?
Very nice to be back, Mary, and my book is available that you mentioned, Lucifer's Lodge, at williamhkennedy.com, and I'm also coming out with another book in about a month and a half from Dragon Key Press entitled Satanic Crime, A Threat in the New Millennium, which will be a very general overview of satanic crime and ritual murder on a worldwide basis over the last 30 years. But as you said earlier, tonight we're going to focus on southeastern Wisconsin. Today I spoke with...
Well, before we get going, okay, another thing for the listeners. Bill has an ongoing site with us at burlingtonnews.net/abuse-in-the-church. As information comes in from Bill on satanic abuse, we put it right on that site. So anyone that wants more information besides going to Bill's site there that he mentioned, what was that again, Bill? William Kennedy.
WilliamHKennedy.com.
Okay. So other than WilliamHKennedy.com, please check burlingtonnews.net/abuse-in-the-church as well. Okay. One more thing. Okay, sure. Now, if you went to the abuseinthechurch.com, you had sent me something in about church ritual, religion or religious or sexual. Wheatland. Now, Wheatland, when you talk about Wheatland, is that Wheatland, Wisconsin?
Yes, Wheatland, Wisconsin.
Okay, because Wheatland is like a stone's throw from here.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Really? Wow.
So anyhow, I just wanted to check that. Okay, so now, now you got your time. Go for
Very
it.
Good.
Sorry about that.
Okay, no problem. I just wanted to say on your site where you were nice enough to put up my stuff, I get a lot of threats from Satanists.
Yeah.
Who have actually looked into my background and called old girlfriends and done some, you know, made all sorts of threats that, you know, everyone has old girlfriends or boyfriends who will, you know, tell them things about themselves. And I just figured I just came right out with it. And there, you can even get a little bit about my past on there, which I decided just to come out with rather than, you know, it's nothing horrible or illegal, just women I dated. And, over the years, I'm a bachelor, you know, and, I just came out with that and put it on your page just to kind of defuse people who, you know, you make a lot of enemies when you do the kind of work I do. So if people want to take a look at that, they're welcome to, and that will take the piffle out of anything that comes out against me in the future.
Well, as a matter of fact, that's what I did. If you remember right, there was about 3 weeks ago, I got hit really hard by this one nut. And anyhow, she set up a website trying to defame me.
Sure, you make a lot of enemies.
Yeah, and actually we traced it back, and guess what? It went right back to the Satanists, and, you know, apparently she was involved in something like that. I don't know how deep she went, that is one thing that Satanists will do, is they'll, and if you want to fight Satanism, that's how you do it. It's exactly what Bill did, and how I do it. You know, you expose them to the light. They have a tendency to want to operate in the darkness. They're like a chihuahua, I think of them like that. You know, they hide under the table, jump out real fast, bite you in the ankle, and then jump back under the table again. But they don't like people to know their names. They don't want to know. Well, they don't want people to know where they're located or anything. But they'll come out. They'll attack your integrity. And then they slip back into the darkness again. So like Bill does, you know, and I did, is we just turned around, both of us, and we just says, hey, and we exposed it. Not only exposed them, but exposed ourselves in the process. But at least that way you operate in the light.
I myself what people say or do, or
well, you can't.
People in my past they talk to. I'd rather just say it myself, because there's nothing all that bad there.
Well, no, and as long as you can turn around and get it out, they have no ammunition.
Well, that's the thing. I'm taking their ammunition away, which is really not that powerful anyway.
No.
So I figured I'd just do it myself.
The only way it's powerful is if they can continue to operate in that darkness.
Right. Very much. But we can move into East Wisconsin now.
Okay.
I should tell people out there, there is a professor at the University of Wisconsin named James R. Lewis, who's at Stevens Point. I've never been to Wisconsin myself, so if I mispronounce anything or mix up my geography, I apologize in advance. And he is in the philosophy department at the University of Wisconsin, and he is Wisconsin's scholar of Satanism, for lack of a better term.
Now, and you know him. What was his name again?
James R. Lewis. And I've emailed him and spoke to him one or two times. I'm not very friendly with, he's not a close friend.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the state of Wisconsin goes, he is the man with all of the knowledge and information. You know, he can give you a panoramic view of Wisconsin, including southeast Wisconsin.
And he's from Stevens Point.
He's from Stevens Point University of Wisconsin Philosophy Department. And he does things like send questionnaires out to various Satanists in Satanist groups, and the people can return these anonymous questionnaires, and he has questions about cattle mutilation and different sorts of things and Satanist beliefs, and that gives him a rough handle on what's going on. Now, as you mentioned earlier, a lot of these people remain in the dark, and it's hard to get a complete grip on things like statistics and numbers, but the closest you can get in Wisconsin would be Dr. James R. Lewis. And I questioned some of the things that were going on in southeastern Wisconsin over the last 6 months or so, and some fascinating things just came up. First of all, I should say that southeastern Wisconsin is a hotbed for satanic activity, as is Wisconsin in general, but in particular southeastern Wisconsin. Usually you can tell that there is a major satanic movement in an area by the legal and very public Satanists who are in a particular area. Now, what you have in your part of Wisconsin is the home of a band, a satanic rock band called the Electric Hellfire Club, which was started up by two fellows, Thomas Thorne and Shane Lassen. They're native Wisconsins. Wisconsiners, I believe is the term. I'm not sure. But they are from your area, and they have lived in various parts of southeastern Wisconsin, including like Madison and Kenosha. Did I pronounce that right? Kenosha?
Kenosha.
I'm sorry. Okay. Kenosha. And they've lived in that area, and they are one of the more public and overt Satanist groups and bands in the world. They're very, very popular. They have a big following. They tour a lot with another Satanist named Boyd Rice, who lives in Denver, Colorado. These people are all generally connected up, and they also are connected to another Satanist from Massachusetts named Michael Moynihan. They are a very popular group within the Satanism movement. Now, what you also have in that part of Wisconsin where you live is a great deal of illegal satanic activity. Now, bands like the Electric Hellfire Club and people like Boyd Rice and Michael Moynihan, they will encourage criminal activity and a variety of other very unwholesome activities to the general satanic population. Now, when anyone confronts them with things that you see in the news about satanic crime, for example, there's a big problem with cattle mutilation between Janesville and Watertown, Wisconsin. You know, they found a lot of mutilated cats and dogs on roadsides. And these animals were butchered in a ritualistic fashion. The police can usually tell by the nature of the dismemberment of the animals. And I don't want to get too much into that, but you can usually tell the difference between, like, a roadkill, an accidental kill, and someone who specifically commits a ritual murder and mutilation of an animal. And when you go to people like Thomas Thorne and Shane Lassen and you just tell them this, you know, in your area, there's been a lot of this sort of very bizarre illegal activity, they immediately jump on the free speech First Amendment bandwagon and distance themselves from it. Now, what they will tell you, like Thomas Thorne, is that what they're doing, their music and their philosophy of life, is all in good fun. And that they don't intend anything really bad to happen, you know. Yet they will write songs encouraging rape. They will write songs encouraging arson. They will write songs encouraging murder. And when other Satanists actually pick up upon this and perform a crime, or commit a crime, I should say, they immediately will just, you know, run for cover under the free speech amendment of the Constitution and not really take any responsibility or ever do anything to discourage people from illegal activities.
But you believe that it is a deliberate attempt?
There's no doubt in my mind, and I should say that, you know, I'm not out to legislate against Satanists. You know, we live in a free country. And you can worship a bowl of Rice Krispies, or you can worship the God in heaven, or you can worship Satan, or you can worship a rock. And I really don't want to take that right away from anyone.
Uh-huh.
But if any of those other religious beliefs lead to criminal activity, certainly the people who commit them are liable. And to a great extent, you know, the people who encourage it are not legally liable, but they're certainly morally liable.
Uh-huh.
And in that sense, I seek to educate and inform about Satanism as opposed to, you know, pass laws against it. And you must keep in mind that for every harmless Satanist, there seems to be a dangerous Satanist out there.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's a matter of law when animals are mutilated and people are raped, and, you know, children are abducted, which is another big problem in southeastern Wisconsin. And in that sense, I think if we get if we give people a full picture of what's going on, especially younger people, you know, teenagers, parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles can inform a teenager and give them a full view of what Satanism is, not just the candy-coated view of Satanism which you see on the internet or from people like the Electric Hellfire Club or Boyd Rice or Shane Bugbee or people like that who say it's in all in good fun. When you give young people the full picture, generally speaking, the average teenager will, of their own accord, kind of shy away from the more dangerous people in this movement.
Mm-hmm.
And once you make them aware that these people exist, they kind of automatically gravitate away from them. And that's really the goal of my work. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to shut down the Electric Hellfire Club so they can't work at clubs anymore. You know, they have the right to do so. But I want people who follow them to realize that there are other followers who are engaged in illegal activities, including the mutilation of animals between Janesville and Watertown. It's, you know, the police are making a big deal of it now. And there's certainly ritualistic elements to these, as I said earlier. And it's very important that people who want to involve themselves in Satanism, in even some forms of Wicca, not all forms of Wicca, should be made to know that not everyone around them may necessarily be a good person.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big thrust of what my work entails. Now, I should say for people out there, I have a general article on my webpage at williamhkennedy.com called Satanism, a Threat in the New Millennium, and that gives you a breakdown of the major figures in the modern Satanism movement, which no matter where you are in the world, including Wisconsin, there's always ties to a few individuals like Aleister Crowley, Anton Zandor LaVey, and I cover the careers of these people in that article. So it's a good idea if people who are interested in this sort of thing. I just gave a synopsis of the key players, which is very important in educating yourself about Satanism. And I kind of wrote a pithy, short article that's meant to inform, and I made it as lively as possible. So people may want to take a look at that. Now, anyone in southeastern Wisconsin who feels they have been a victim of a satanic crime or witnessed a satanic crime or found evidence of a satanic crime should really contact Dr. James R. Lewis at the University of Wisconsin at Stevens Point and just give, you know, maybe send him an email. I don't have his email address, but just let him know what's going on because he's very interested in getting this bird's eye view of the situation, particularly in Wisconsin. I've had a lot of reports. There's a great deal of problem with Satanists dealing drugs in Madison, mm-hmm. Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
According to police reports, you know, when you get arrested by the police, they usually make note of your physical characteristics and any tattoos you might have.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a rash of recent reports of people who got caught selling crack cocaine and regular cocaine and especially amphetamines, methamphetamines, in the Madison area. And when they give a description on the police reports of any tattoos, you get things like devil tattoos, you get things like a pentagram with 666 written in it. You get a lot of 666 tattoos. And these are coming up in public police reports on arrests in Madison. So in the Madison area, you have a strong connection between self-styled street Satanists and the drug trade, which is quite a horrible, you know, thing to contemplate when you consider how dangerous things like methamphetamine and crack are. Satanists don't seem to mind being purveyors of it to the general population. And when you look at it on that level, that's just outright criminal activity mm-hmm. on the part of Satanists.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you start to connect the dots, you see that there is this large subculture of illegal Satanists, I call them, in southeastern Wisconsin, who have a criminal network, an organized crime network of drugs. And I don't have any evidence, but I strongly, strongly suspect that they are also involved with a lot of these cattle and calf and pet mutilations that are found in the Janesville area.
Mm-hmm.
The police in Wisconsin actually take Satanism very, very seriously
mm-hmm.
because they see the effects of it. And I talked to a fellow who was with the state police in Wisconsin who was working on the Father Alfred Kuhn's murder, which occurred in Wisconsin in the late 90s, Father Coons, there's a whole chapter about him in my book, Lucifer's Lodge. He was a priest in Wisconsin who was murdered in his church, and it's strongly believed that it was a satanic murder. Now, the state police in Wisconsin are still looking for his murderer. They haven't found him as of yet. It's still an open case. They haven't closed it up to this juncture. But talking to the police there, law enforcement in Wisconsin, you know, they will not scoff at you if you contact their media people and ask them about Satanism. Uh-huh. They will give you kind of a breakdown of what I just said. They take it very seriously. They don't put it on the back burner like a lot of law enforcement in other parts of the country certainly do. It's difficult to, it's difficult in some areas to get law enforcement to take this seriously, but Wisconsin is one place where the police certainly do, as I said, because they keep arresting Satanists for various sorts of things, illegal activities. Now, there's been a spurt of missing children in southeastern Wisconsin, and I can't, you know, directly connect it to Satanists myself, but it's in the same areas that these mutilations are taking place. And when you get in things like the illicit drug trade, which it's incontrovertible that Satanists in southeastern Wisconsin are involved in, usually that goes hand in hand with other things like prostitution and even child prostitution. So I have a strong suspicion there might be Satanists behind at least some of these abductions within that area.
So you said that there's a lot of missing children abductions?
Yes, there has been as of lately, mostly by children I mean people in their early teens,
uh-huh,
who are often deemed runaways.
Uh-huh.
And when the police take down the details, I'm talking 12, 13, 14-year-olds,
uh-huh,
when they say, well, who were his friends, what was he or she into, what were they doing, and they, you know, they will even look at their personal belongings. And a lot of these young people, both boys and girls, were on the fringe of Satanism, particularly through various forms of heavy metal and black metal music.
Uh-huh.
And that makes the police there, again, suspect that there might be a connection with this organized illegal satanic network, which, you know, it's incontrovertible that they do exist, with snatching these kids. Now, generally, if you're over 13 and you disappear, you're deemed a runaway. You know, if you're under that, if you're like 8 or 9 or 10, you're usually considered abducted. But I suspect that these, you know, young adolescents are being abducted by the same satanic network that operates, you know, between Wisconsin and Janesville and even Burlington, from what I understand.
Uh-huh.
And we were talking earlier, and you were saying, Mary, that you have information, and people in that area talk about a tunnel system.
Yeah.
And could you fill me in a little bit on that?
Well, what we do know is that, now there's first of all, there's a tunnel system. People around this area just refer to it as the Underground Railroad, but it dates way back to the Mound Builders, actually. It's a very complex tunnel system that it interconnects all through the United States, you know, but there's this one tunnel system that Al Capone used to use for distributing bootleg booze, you know, and they're so big that they were able to make his runs underground in large trucks. And they would take them to the various speakeasies. How I've been able to trace down the tunnels is by finding the speakeasies of the, you know, of that era. And because wherever the speakeasy is, you'll find like an entrance to one of the tunnels, and then they'll find like every one of the entrances are blocked off. They're, you know, cemented up, you know, with, you know, these great big cement blocks, you know. But So anyhow, I've been able to find at least three or four of those entrances, you know, here in Burlington, and, you know, and it, wherever Capone lived, too, it seemed to be that he would have his home there. Wherever his home was, there would be like an entrance to one of these tunnels. There, you find them. A lot of people in Burlington area found them, like in their cellars or in their basements. You know, there would be like a little trap door. They can pull up that trap door, and it'll go right down into a tunnel.
Wow, that's amazing. Because according to the police there, the big trouble they're having in that area is finding the methamphetamine labs where they might be.
Uh huh.
And the thing is, to make methamphetamine is a very sophisticated chemical process. You have to build a very elaborate chemical laboratory in order to produce methamphetamine, and you need chemicals which are very, very difficult to come by. And the enigma for the police in that region, especially Madison, as I said earlier, is that they cannot trace or find where these where the meth labs are. Normally, in other parts of the country.
Well, we know that those underground tunnels extend into Madison or under Madison.
Well, that's kind of what I'm connecting. I suspect now, and this is, I'm a little theoretical now, and this is purely my speculation. I suspect that those labs would probably be subterranean on some level.
Mm-hmm.
And the big thing is, in other parts of the country, generally speaking, they can trace a meth lab by finding out where chemicals are being shipped.
Mm-hmm.
And you can even make methamphetamine, believe it or not, out of certain kinds of sinus tablets.
Mm-hmm.
And usually what they'll do is they'll look for someone who purchases, 5,000 boxes of these sinus tablets,
mm-hmm.
and the people involved don't own a shop or a store.
Mm-hmm.
So there's different ways they can trace a meth lab, but in Madison, it's just a complete dead end for them. They cannot figure out where the chemicals to make the meth is coming from, and they can't find any traces of the labs. I mean, they even do things like go into Home Depot and find out who is buying specific sorts of equipment.
Well, I just found out, someone came in here the other day and told me that we have this great big parking lot just around the corner from me, and there's like in between the parking lot there's like a St. Vincent thrift store, and then on the other side is a hardware store. And lo and behold, he told me that underneath that parking lot is an underground area, and it was it used to be an old bowling alley, okay, and the entrance to it was at St. Vincent's. You could go downstairs and then manage to get back up in there. So I mean, like, if you got facilities set up underground the size of a bowling alley, you could definitely run a meth lab there.
And you could get your supplies probably from other parts of the country.
Well, you could get them right through the illegals coming up through Mexico.
Sure, sure. Or from other countries themselves.
Yeah.
Because
we've checked the borders down there. Last year we were down there watching the borders, and those borders just are not guarded at all. As a matter of fact,
we went
right through two, right down there in the El Paso area. We went through two border checks and never got checked once. As a matter of fact, the first border check that we went through, there was a truck going through ahead of us, pickup with a cover on the back, and that cover, and inside it was just loaded with Mexicans. And when they went through that checkpoint, Brad told me, he says, "Well, those guys could get pulled over and be checked, you know, for sure." And they motioned them right on through, never even bothered to check them.
Just waved them
right on through. And then we went up to the second checkpoint, and that one was closed. So I mean, it's not that difficult to sneak to bring illegal drugs up through Mexico, and then have them distributed up here, and then those meth labs set up down there in those underground tunnels.
It's quite amazing because, as I said, the meth problem there is terrible, and the police can't find any of the normal traces that you see in other parts of the country.
Mm-hmm. Well, and if they start looking down underground, they might find it.
I think they had better, because it makes a lot of sense what you're saying. Now, there is also...
Well, the people here in Burlington area, you know, where these tunnels have been sealed up, they claim today that they still hear voices, you know, in there. And, of course, the super people that are superstitious, they think that, you know, they're ghosts or something like that. Now, me, even though I do a paranormal show, you know, I still use common sense. Common sense tells me that there's people down there and voice carries through the tunnels. And,
sure.
And they're picking up, and the voices would come out wherever there'd be an entrance or an exit, you know, because it'd funnel out through. And that's where they're hearing those voices, if somebody's working in those tunnels.
Oh, sure. I mean, they could be hearing the meth lab. It could be something that's not supernatural at all.
Uh-huh. And then here, there's another little town a couple miles outside of Burlington, and it's called Waterford. In Waterford, they had the tunnels and they sealed off. And anyhow, someone was trying to check them out for me. They found, like a lot of them, you'll find like in the houses, there'll be like I said, these trap doors. You get down to the trap doors and there's like crawl spaces. You know, they're very small, but they're crawl spaces. But if you follow these crawl spaces far enough, it'll open up into a bigger tunnel. And that tunnel opens up into almost cavernous type areas. For instance, in Waterford, this one found one of those tunnels over by what they call, Chance's Restaurant. It's next to it. Chance's is known to have an underground tunnel there, too. But this one was in a house, and they went down in there, and they crawled through, and it opened up into a large tunnel. But when they got into the large tunnel, that where it led, that was blocked off, but they broke like a piece, you know, they broke through a little bit, and they managed to throw a rock in there, and they said it echoed, you know, so they felt that because of the echo that they were hearing, it sounded to them like it was a large cavernous area. And so they went back and they told one of the elders of that town about what they had discovered. And he got really upset and he says, listen, we sealed those off for a reason. Because a long time ago we used to hear screams and moans coming from them. Like it was coming from hell itself, the voices of hell itself. So they sealed it off. Well, this is where my alarm went off, because I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute. You know, that's superstition saying that. But nobody bothered to go into those tunnels to see if it really wasn't maybe some victims down there, maybe people that had been abducted, kidnapped, whatever, and taken down in there for some sort of satanic purposes.
Now, that makes me wonder if some of these missing, you know, very young, early teen people who certainly are going missing in that area, and they have this obvious connection to Satanism, usually via black metal and heavy metal music, that's where they might be winding up.
That's why I wanted to talk to you, is because that's what I think is happening to these missing teenagers.
That's amazing, because there's also a problem with El Salvadoran gangs in that area who are coming up. This I got from a Madison police officer. El Salvadoran gangs are jumping the border, and they tend to be satanic in nature. Like, they have a lot of, that's how they're spotted by the police. They generally have satanic tattoos on them.
Mm-hmm.
They go by a variety of names, whatever city they're in. For instance, here in Massachusetts, where I am, they're called the MS Club.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Mad Salvadorans.
Mm-hmm.
And you can usually spot them because they have, as I said, like pentagrams and what they call a laugh now, cry later tattoo, which is kind of like the Roman god Janus, the mm-hmm. god of portals, you know, one face smiling, one face crying, sad.
Uh-huh, like the Divine Comedy.
Right, exactly. And there's a big problem with them coming up and getting heavily involved in the drug trade. They are involved with the illegal importation of immigrants, usually for slave labor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this gang, they're in every, this El Salvadoran Satanist gang is in every major city, including South eastern Wisconsin.
Well, see, we sit right between Chicago and Milwaukee.
Right.
Two major cities.
Right. So anyone who goes to those cities, some of these, you know, gangs who would be attracted to Chicago would find themselves in places like Janesville and, you know, Madison and Burlington.
Yeah, the sleepy little towns.
The sleepy little towns are usually the most dangerous, I find. The big cities are people are much more on guard, but the sleepy little towns are where the freaky stuff tends to happen, in my reckoning. You know?
Well, see, we've been getting reports because, see, I did a study on the, you know, there's a report of the Bray Road Beast here in the Burlington area, in Elkhorn, actually. But it's actually Bray Road's in between Elkhorn and Burlington. And, you know, so I was checking out the police reports, and they said that they would find, like, areas where there would be, like, a dump of cats and dogs, you know. And to me, it was, you know, and to the police as well, it wasn't no Bray Road Beast. They wrote it up as a satanic, results of satanic
activity.
Right?
Now, it's just amazing because when you look at these satanic gangs in particular, they do traffic in the slave trade as well. I know the El Salvadoran satanic gang does. It's just my big question, and what I'm trying to put together is how connected these people would be nationally and internationally. And the more I look at it, the more I see links between all of these groups.
Yeah.
Now, in Wisconsin, there's definitely an illegal Satanist network or mafia or whatever you want to call it involved in the drug and international slave trade.
And we're talking now, slave trade is sexual, right?
Primarily sex slaves, you know.
Yeah, sex slaves. And these young girls, these 13, 14, 16-year-old girls, they'd be perfect for them.
Well, that's who they generally target. They like girls about that age.
Uh-huh.
You know, they want the maximum they can get sexually out of people they grab in a someone just emerging in the adolescence. They can get 20, 25 years out of, you know, in the sex trade. That's how these people think. I'm sorry to put it that way on the radio. It's not my thoughts, but that's generally how they think.
Uh-huh.
And at about that age as well, they can usually write them off as runaways.
Mm-hmm. But when you're hearing, when you're getting reports about, or when I'm getting reports about screams and moans, you know, to me, for coming out of those tunnels, you know, or entrances, what are the, you know, screams and moans, you know, that's pain. And, you know, if those tunnels are down there, which I know they are, and, you know, and Al Capone had the site to use them for illegal practices.
Right.
Why would he be? Why would he? Yeah. Why would he be the exception? You know, I mean, if a person got into those tunnels, seen the how big they are, how elaborate they are, and how big some of them are. Like I said, that one here in Burlington under that parking lot, the size of it was no bowling alley. That's big. I mean, they could have cities down there. I mean, taking people
down there,
in their groups, you know, for every possible thing you could imagine. You know, not only drugs and their sex slaves, but torture. You know, God only knows.
Sure. Well, I'll lay a bombshell on you, Mary, which I doubt you know this fact, but Anton Zandor LaVey, who was the founder of the Church of Satan in 1966, who wrote the Satanic Bible and the Satanic Rituals, which all of these sorts of groups use as a sort of Quran or Bible, he had an uncle who was tied in with Al Capone.
Mm-hmm.
And his uncle operated within Chicago and southeastern Wisconsin. That was kind of his territory. He was involved. He was a rum runner.
And a lot of the Al Capone, including Al Capone himself, had summer homes here in Burlington.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
And there's a direct connection between Capone's gang and Anton Zandor LaVey, the founder of the Church of Satan. So it doesn't go, you know, it's within the realm of possibility that the Capone, which later became the Accardo crime family mob, would have passed this knowledge on to Anton Zandor LaVey or some of his followers, other Satanists. And they could have just taken up, you know, these underground tunnels and used them for the drug and sex slave trade as opposed to the liquor trade. Once Prohibition ended, those tunnels probably lay dormant for a while.
Oh, yeah.
Until the drug trade came in.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a direct connection between Capone's gang and the modern Satanism movement, which most people aren't really aware of. And from what you're saying, the Chicago mob has strong ties in Burlington, Wisconsin. It's just absolutely amazing that Anton Zandor LaVey's uncle was one of Capone's main henchmen.
Mm-hmm.
He went to prison, federal prison, many, many times.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually how Anton Zandor LaVey got jobs in the strip joints and burlesque houses in San Francisco, was because his uncle was one of Al Capone's henchmen. And the West Coast United States, L.A. and San Francisco, where LaVey was from, they, in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, were actually controlled by the Chicago mob.
Mm-hmm.
So the strip joints in San Francisco, which there again have a strong Satanist element, which LaVey worked in, there's an intricate tie between Satanism and organized crime in Chicago and the Wisconsin area. And there again, these links, which most people aren't aware of, and most teenagers know nothing about, it just makes sense when you put all these puzzle pieces together, you get a very interesting picture of a mafia-slash-satanic-slash-drug-dealing sex trade, now with the El Salvadoran gang either usurping it or going in cahoots with the organizations that are already there. Now, the El Salvadorans themselves were Satanists in El Salvador, and when they came up to places like Madison and Burlington and Chicago, it would make sense that they would fuse in with the remnants of Capone's old gang, which certainly is still in operation.
Oh, you bet it is.
You know, it's still there. It never went away.
But they just cleaned it up.
Right, right.
They
just candy-coated it a bit. They all live on Lakeshore Drive and have houses in Burlington, I guess, and are a little more respectable. But as far as the nitty-gritty, you know, drug manufacturing and drug dealing, the older mobsters tend to hire, or I shouldn't say hire, but they will make connections with younger gangsters. And the younger gangsters who are in Chicago and southeastern Wisconsin at this time, the major force that everyone is frightened of, even the Russian mob keeps away from them, are these El Salvadoran Satanists.
You betcha. We experienced them when we did an investigation down in Arizona. They were running drugs across from Mexico into, and they were actually using the police force as their runners.
Yeah. Oh, sure. I mean, they're in the same sense that Al Capone paid off most of the police in that part of the country, in the Great Lakes cities. You know, he had people on his bankroll and every police force there. These drug-dealing Satanists, slave traders, they took over that part of the business. They have very strong ties to law enforcement.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of them are just on the take. And all the bad policeman has to do is look the other way at the right time, and a crime can be committed and gotten away with.
Mm-hmm.
And they can, for certain issues, they can, you know, not really look too hard for who is behind it, like with the problem with the methamphetamine labs, you know?
Well, now, you know, like, I think that, like, in the big cities, you know, that they might have a lot, or not a lot, but they've got some of the police that's on the take there. But I think, like, with the smaller towns like Burlington and Kenosha and and Sheboygan and all those places. I think more what it is that they're sleepy towns, and the police just aren't
looking for it.
They're not watching for it because they're still thinking small town, you know.
Right.
USA. Yeah.
I'm not maligning local law enforcement at all. The average police officer out there is an honest public service servant who's just doing their best under the conditions they have.
Yeah.
But corrupt individuals within law enforcement, especially when you get into people like narcotics agents and the detective units, if they become corrupt, and I'm not saying all of them are corrupt either, that's what really causes a lot of the, you know, living hell in our cities and in small towns.
But when you turn your, you know, but that's why they choose these small towns, though, is because, I mean, they're prime. Because they know that, you know, the police are looking at their little towns as like small town USA, you know, and they just look at it like they can come in, and these officers aren't going to be watching for it. And if they've got these things set up underground, well, I know that our town is looking underground. They, you know, and I know that there's a lot of them that's not looking underground. And from what you say, Madison, they're having a hard time locating where these labs are as well. But if, boy, I'll tell you, somebody could get down on in the, you know, into these sealed entrance ways. I'll tell you, I think that they, you know, actually, well, the way I look at it, you go in, you check to make sure everything is clean. If it is, good. If it's not, well, you know, you've taken care of the matter, you know.
Right.
But if you never go down, then, I mean, it's a prime area for crime.
Oh, sure, sure. And it's well hidden. And as you said earlier, the organized crime in Chicago and the region of Wisconsin where you are from, it just makes a lot of sense that, you know, the remnants of Al Capone's gang would have left some sort of map or, you know, instructions on how to use this tunnel system. And parts of this tunnel system are probably, you know, sealed off and such and not in use at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there's any amount or number of them that are of consequence. But when talking to people who are new to this subject, you know, you really have to emphasize the fact that it is beyond dispute that illegal criminals on both borders in Canada and in Mexico use tunnel systems to import people and illegal drugs. And as we mentioned earlier, Capone ran booze through it.
Mm-hmm.
But to look at it and to consider the fact of all these missing children and all these mutilated animals, it just becomes very, very bizarre. Now, I've never met a Satanist who didn't talk about some sort of tunnel system, believe it or not, and the overt example I can give you is Charles Manson. Now, when Charles Manson was out in Death Valley in California outside of L.A., he taught his followers that there were underground cities and that there were underground tunnel systems. And they spent a great deal of their time out in Death Valley trying to find entrances to this underground tunnel system. So, and Charles Manson was certainly a Satanist. He identified himself as Satan in various rituals. He also identified himself as Jesus Christ, which is another form of Satanism. And he definitely talked about these tunnel systems. Now, I'll have to check this with James R. Lewis, who's at the, as I said earlier, at the University of Wisconsin at Stevens Point, if he's heard anything about it. But I have heard from various Satanists I've gotten emails from. It's a commonly talked about thing amongst the satanic community, these underground areas. And it would be interesting to find out, you know, the origin of this, which a lot of people take as, there again, an urban myth or an urban legend.
Mm-hmm.
But it's certainly not an urban legend in that you know, the police themselves, honest policemen and honest federal agents, have discovered these sorts of tunnels on our borders.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
And the El Salvadoran gangs, now, there was an El Salvadoran gang leader here in Massachusetts who they deported. They sent him back to El Salvador, and like 3 months later, a policeman recognized him a few blocks from where they caught him. He got right back in here,
mm-hmm.
you know, with no problem. So that suggests to me that there is this elaborate tunnel system. And when you consider these El Salvadoran gangs are Satanists in nature, you know, with their tattoos and they claim to be Satanists, it just makes me wonder how extensive this network of tunnels might be.
I think it's a good point that you brought up, because see, they're used to these tunnels. They've used them all the time. So it would only make sense that when they came up into the United States, they'd be looking for these tunnels.
Well, sure. It's just bizarre when you look at the hard facts that are already established. You know, that, as I said earlier, the Church of Satan, Anton LaVey, had strong ties to the Chicago mob, which used these tunnels. You see things like you mentioned earlier, people just wandering across the border with no particular checks. How many more are coming underground?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, the thousands more, if they're not looking above ground, they're certainly not looking underground.
And that's the whole key, is until they start looking underground and opening up these tunnel entrances and getting in there, we'll never know.
Right, right, right.
And my biggest concern is those missing kids.
Well, sure, that would be the ultimate concern in all of this, and certainly the victims of the methamphetamine people fund, you know?
First of all, there has been in the last month an outbreak in Burlington and all the small towns around it, including Kenosha, of all these break-ins. They're coming in, kicking in the back doors of these businesses and only stealing cash.
Wow.
And two days ago, I believe it was, three businesses right here in Burlington were, again, robbed.
Wow, so you're having a mini crime wave where you are.
Very big. It's big. Oh. It's actually big, because it's all these small towns that they're hitting nightly.
Wow.
And they got the police just running crazy, and they can't catch them.
Wow, that's amazing.
So, you know, there again, I'm thinking, well, you know, why are they just taking cash? Well, to me, if they're just taking cash, it's probably drug-related. If it's drug-related, well, then you got to say, well, who's running the drugs? Where and how are they getting the drugs? Where are they making the drugs? Then it takes me right back to possibly those underground tunnels.
It's quite fascinating, because when you look at the facts that you see on police blotters that you get in newspapers and police reports in
uh-huh.
general, it's generally public record, most police arrests in most cases.
Mm-hmm.
99% of them are public record things. You have like an outer core, which is technically legitimate, like the Electric Hellfire Club, and then around it you see all of the effects of a bad Satanism or illegal Satanism, like the mutilated calves, missing persons, methamphetamine dealings, robberies for cash.
Well, you know, the dots all connect, don't they?
Sure, the dots all connect, and that's the amazing thing about it. Now, the problem is when you talk to the average person out there, there's a lot of disinfo that goes around. You know, there's a lot of disinformation, and the idea of an underground tunnel network, if you were to just say that to someone out of the blue, you know, they would find that an absurd notion.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess what I'm saying is to your listeners, if you want to inform people of this situation, the best place to start, especially in your part of Wisconsin, is to talk about and get some documentation on the Internet about Al Capone's initial tunnel system and build up your arguments from there.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing. That's what
right.
Exactly
that's where you really got to start, and that's a good method, Mary, and that's a good way for all of your listeners to discuss this with family and friends. start with that fact and then move on to, you know, Al Capone's main hitman, his henchman, was Anton LaVey's uncle, who was a founder of the Church of Satan. And then you can go on with the other facts we talked about earlier, like most of the people who are busted selling methamphetamines have all these satanic tattoos. And you can link all these things together, but there again, you have to find a particular strategy in order to introduce this sort of information to other people.
Well, I think I'm definitely going to be talking to this Dr. James R. Lewis.
Sure, I can send you some information on how to contact him. Like I say, I don't know him very well, but he is just trying to get a bird's eye view of what's going on in Satanism in Wisconsin. And he's the sort of person, if you started off the conversation or started off your email with talking about the elaborate tunnel system, mm-hmm. he would probably immediately write you off. He would be highly skeptical.
Yeah.
And there again, it's all your approach. It's how you go about it. You have to do it very systematically, and you have to give people what they can absorb at first. And I tend to do this very slowly with new people. I'll give them a few facts, let them check it, and let them draw their own conclusion.
Well, the mind has a way of protecting. So what it doesn't want to accept, it just closes down to.
Well, sure, but The thing you can emphasize is you can point out all these missing teenagers. You can point out all these problems with amphetamines. You can give people enough hard facts that you can have them check on the internet from valid news services and news networks and such, and build up from there. But I find with people who are closed, you really have to give them the information piecemeal.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you have to convince them, first of all, first and foremost, that, you know, organized crime during the Prohibition era used tunnels to run rum and liquor across the borders in Mexico and Canada. You have to establish that as a fact, and that may take a little time for a hard or skeptical person to really absorb and accept, and then you can build it up from there. But if you lay all the facts on someone at once, they're just going to, you know, shut right up and not really want to think about any of it. And there's a case in Belgium of a man named Marc Dutroux, who was just sentenced to life in prison for being a slave trader. He would basically abduct girls 12, 13, like we were talking about earlier, and he would sell them to the international slave trade market. Now, he's a person who owned like 7 homes around Belgium, and there was a big controversy over there because when he was arrested initially, he had a lot of ties to Satanists. The first news articles talked about ties to Satanism, and then it was quickly dropped, and they just focused on the fact that Dutroux was a sex slave trader. Now, while he was in prison, he effected an escape. He grabbed a gun from a guard when he was being taken to a courthouse, and he got away for about 3 hours. He grabbed the gun, held everyone hostage, stole a car, and 3 hours later, some just ordinary citizens spotted him, and they arrested him and put him back in jail. Now, I think it was a year and a half after that, some independent group which checks on the treatment of prisoners checked Marc Dutroux's cell, and they discovered a set of handcuff keys that only a guard would have. Now, the people in Belgium suspect that Dutroux was being aided by someone within law enforcement to escape. You know, he escaped once, and ordinary citizens actually found him. And then later on, they found handcuff keys in his cell, which for a prisoner in a cell to have handcuff keys, he would have had to have been given them by a guard or police officer. Now, here's where it gets very, very bizarre, and again ties into the greater picture. Two writers in Belgium went out and started to interview some of the victims who were involved with this slave trade, and they started talking about how they were sexually involved with King Albert of Belgium, who's headquartered in Brussels. They kept saying that they were sexually abused by King Albert.
Okay.
And these were people who were abducted by Marc Dutroux, who initially had ties to a satanic organizations who are also slave traders. So it's the people of Belgium suspect that it was actually the King of Belgium who was aiding and abetting Marc Dutroux to escape. In fact, their Attorney General of Belgium had to resign over the Marc Dutroux escape. And that's a case over there where you have a connection with, you know, between this illegal international Satanist network, which is, of course, in the, particularly the Madison area in Wisconsin, involved with these higher-level or elite Satanists. The King of Belgium, King Albert, is a member of the Bilderbergers.
Oh, yeah.
Which,
okay,
you know, George Bush is a member.
Yeah.
So you do have these bizarre ties with, you know, high government officials and what I like to call elite Satanists, you know, Bohemian Grove people and Skull and Bones people. Now, there again, King Albert took the two writers who brought this fact out to court,
uh-huh.
and the judge in the court interviewed some of the victims,
uh-huh.
and his judgment was very bizarre. King Albert wanted the book taken off the market that
uh-huh.
these fellows wrote about.
Uh-huh.
And the judge, after talking to the victims now, he determined that he could not legally stop them from publishing this book because
wow.
the testimonies of the victims were so compelling and detailed that he left the book on the market. He made one change. He demanded the judge, the ruling was, the judge said that there had to be a footnote that King Albert denies these charges and deeply resents the fact that this was said about him, but nowhere did the judge pull the book or make them change anything that was in that book.
Oh, yeah, that's unusual because you would be think that the judge would be so intimidated by the king.
No, the evidence that what the authors of this book said, and I'll send you a link and an article about this
okay.
later. What the judge said was there were so many victims from, you know, who were reliable and from normal walks of life who would come testify. You know, if the judge had banned the book, the people who wrote it were going to appeal the case in the European Court of Appeals,
uh-huh.
you know, the European Union,
mm-hmm.
and they were going to bring forward these witnesses who would give testimony, and the judge, in a sense, might have been protecting the king in that if he had banned the book,
mm-hmm.
It would have went, and these people would have told what happened to them and what the king did to them to the whole world
yeah,
at the European
yeah.
court.
Yeah, that makes
so
sense.
In that sense, he did protect the King of Belgium, King Albert.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very, very bizarre because there again, Marc Dutroux had ties to a Satanist network who were involved in pedophiles. Now, when you look at the international picture and you start to put all of these puzzle pieces together, you wouldn't think the King of Belgium had anything to do with Southeast Wisconsin.
Yeah.
You know, you wouldn't think he had that there were no ties whatsoever. But a similar thing that's happening in Southeast Wisconsin is happening in Belgium.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same series of events.
Well, the network is just worldwide.
It's international.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. And that's one of the problems that
people are, you know, and we would like to just turn around and it would be so much easier for us to accept if we could just point to the Salvadorians, you know, or some of these gangs. But they're actually just, they're the very bottom man on this totem pole.
Did the brown shorts.
Yeah, but there are some people of very high positions that are making a lot of money off this. You know.
Oh, definitely so. I mean, it's.
I mean, like you said, it takes you all the way to the very top. So, I mean, who do you fight? I mean, you know, because, I mean, the very people, you know, the Bilderbergers, that elite organization up there, I mean, God forbid, you know, if they're involved in something like this, that's a heck of a lot of power to take down, which would be impossible to do.
It really is, and with local law enforcement looking after missing teenagers, as you say, in your part of the country, law enforcement is more interested in people who are speeding
mm-hmm.
and people who are involved in lesser crimes until, you know, shop doors get kicked in and the cash is stolen,
uh-huh.
until a crime wave hits them, which is drug-related, and then all the dominoes kind of fall for them, and they see that they are victims of something which is much larger than
yeah.
what their capacity can handle.
Yeah, and you're right. The police force actually does also become a victim.
And to a certain extent, sure, because it's just beyond their capacity or scope to ever, you know, ultimately solve or end this sort of case, because it goes to the very highest offices of government. I mean, President Bush was a Bilderberger, and he's also involved in the Skull and Bones.
Yeah.
And allegedly, he was involved with some Satanist group in Texas many years ago.
Oh, yeah, I remember that scandal.
Oh, yeah, I mean, and that's a very, you know, it's odd. President Bush didn't deny that happened.
Oh, he never did. No, he just said that there was other pending, or other things more pending right at that point in time.
There were more important
things
to talk
yeah,
about than the Satanist group he was involved in
yeah.
in Texas. There again, a big place that
even though every one of those people that was on that ranch were found dead and bite marks on them.
With bite marks on them that match some of them that match Bush's.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and there again, it's in Texas that a lot of these El Salvadoran gang members come through to get into the United States.
Yeah.
So you have all these bizarre ties between lower level Satanists, you know, kind of brown shirts like Hitler's brown shirts, and you have these higher level people like President Bush and King Albert of Belgium.
Yeah.
And it just gets very, very bizarre. And there again, when you educate people about this, you have to give it to them very piecemeal and let them absorb little bits of it.
Well, the way I look at this, and this is what, because I have this one lady, I can't tell you her name because I'm protecting her, but her son was, she thought, abducted by, quote, aliens, right? But then, as she started listening to her son and everything, watching the things that was going on, she comes to me and says, you know what, I don't think it's aliens at all. I think there's some sort of a factor that is very human that actually took my son. And she went on to tell me, and I agree with her, and she went on to tell me that he was taken down into the tunnel system.
Wow.
And he saw these people walking around in there that were all human, and they were like drugged up. He says they just walked around in a stare. You know what I mean? A blank stare.
Drug addled. Yeah.
And they were doing various things, but anyhow, they says that somehow they control him. You know, they come and get him every once in a while. And I'm thinking to myself, well, how could they do that? But now, are Satanists involved in mind control?
Oh, certainly. I mean,
a
major, major part of...
So they could give him some sort of a hypnotic suggestion when he was down there to actually come back on his own.
Sure,
and he could,
sure.
And then put something in his head saying, "Well, we are the aliens, and we have abducted you."
Certainly,
you know what I mean.
Certainly,
you know. So
and
that if he ever told the story, you know, who's going to listen to that story, right? They would just laugh it off.
Well, I can give you an overt example. Michael Occhino, who was Anton LaVey's number one disciple at one time. When he joined the Church of Satan, he was an army officer. I believe he was a major at the time, and he later was promoted to colonel. He was a career army officer, and his specialty was mind control and psychological operations, a PSYOP expert for the U.S. government. He joined the Church of Satan in the late 60s while serving at the Presidio Army Base in San Francisco. And later on, he had a falling out with Anton LaVey and formed his own group called the Temple of Set.
Okay.
Which is a spin-off Satanist group.
Yeah, that's spelled S-E-T, right?
S-E-T, the Temple of Set. But there again, you mentioned mind control and brainwashing and things like that.
Uh-huh.
Michael Aquino was a government expert. That was his profession in the U.S. military. He was a mind control and propaganda and psychological operations expert.
So they are using them, those type of people.
Oh,
in their operation.
Definitely so. Aquino is the most overt example, and he would know all of the things you were just talking about, how to put in different sorts of hypnotic codes and orders that could be triggered by various things to make someone like the victim you were talking about return to a certain place at a certain time. You know, they can create now, I checked this out with several psychiatrists, people involved in mind control and brainwashing can create what is called an amnesic barrier. And what an amnesic barrier is a particular form of brainwashing wherein different periods of time are not forgotten by the individual, but they are put in kind of on in the back burner of the mind, in the subconscious of the mind.
Uh-huh.
And you can trigger, use certain trigger codes in hypnosis to put people into, to form an amnesic barrier so a person will forget like 3 or 4 months or a week, and they will have no recollection of it. And you can use other trigger codes to make those people return to that state of mind and come back to their abusers. I mean, this is proven by psychiatrists and psychologists. Anyone with a few years of hypnotic training can certainly do this. It's empirically verifiable. So in the Satanist community, this is, as I say, Michael Aquino, who's an expert at these things, was a major propagandist for the Church of Satan in his own group. And it only follows that other spin-off groups and other Satanists and other government Satanists, for lack of a better term, certainly would have knowledge of and would employ these techniques. You know, it's nothing. In fact, that part of what we're talking about is the most provable by documentation via Michael Aquino.
Okay, now I want to go on. Now, this lady, okay,
sure.
She told me this in confidence, and but I know that she... You know that.
Well, you don't use
no,
name.
But as long, yeah, I'm not going to. But she told me that her father, okay, was at one point in time they had no money, okay, and then he made a deal with he joined this organization in this area, and this organization, you know, when he joined that organization, there was one thing that he was to do. He would be able to get everything he wanted, but at the end of 7 years, he had to give his soul to Satan. And she says it was like overnight they had all this money. He had the best jobs. He had, they were able to, you know, they were living in a brand new home, brand new cars. They were able to take all these wonderful vacations and stuff like that. And then she said at the end of the 7 years, okay, he said no to it. As a matter of fact, him and the family split up and he took off. But she feels, okay, that because he made that commitment to someone, some group here in this area, the 7 years, you know, when the 7 years came up and he didn't fulfill it, that because of it, that's the reason her son's being taken now.
Oh, well, certainly. That's a very common theme, generational obligations to satanic organizations.
Okay, you want to tell me about it so that...
Oh, sure.
Because I know she's going to be listening to this show.
Oh, sure. Well, there are certainly generational Satanists in the world. They are family lines who are involved with satanic organizations of different sorts. And if one generation member betrays or in any way does not live up to their obligation to the Satanist organization, the Satanist organization often in retaliation will do something to a family member, a son or a daughter, or make an overt effort to recruit them back into the organization as a form of revenge against the parent or even grandfather who betrayed them. So that's a very, very common theme, generational Satanism. And the organization that comes to mind is the Skull and Bone Society, which President Bush is a member of, which is at Yale University. It's a fraternity on the campus of Yale, which was founded in 1832. And just in brief, as part of their initiation ceremony, members at Yale, including President Bush and Senator John Kerry, the last part of their initiation into the Skull and Bone Society involves them kneeling before three other students who are dressed up in costumes. One is dressed as Lucifer with horns. One is dressed as the Antichrist, who's wearing a Pope's mitre and has his foot on the skull. And the third figure is a Black Knight, who actually dubs them a full member of the order. And they kneel before these three figures. And whether they know it or not, what they're kneeling before is the Infernal Trinity. It is the inversion of the Christian Trinity of Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. And my point being is that all Skull and Bones members have already turned their souls over to Lucifer at this initiation ceremony, which usually occurs when they're, you know, 19, 20, 21 years old. And they have made that commitment to this satanic organization, the Skull and Bones. Now, it's a highly secret society. You know, Bush won't talk about it. Kerry won't talk about it. President Bush, number one, won't talk about it. You know, major, major figures in U.S. Economy and politics were members. Avril Harriman, Henry Luce, the founder of Time Magazine, was a Skull and Bonesman. The founder of Federal Express was a Skull and Bonesman. William F. Buckley is a Skull and Bonesman. And what happens is they are, by obligation, supposed to operate for the benefit of other Skull and Bones members. And what I've heard, I'm actually in contact with several Skull and Bonesmen who have drifted away from any involvement with the organization. They don't necessarily, they won't come looking for you, but if they need a favor from you, and you're a Skull and Bonesman, they will ask you. But they don't particularly monitor everyone who was a member unless they need you for something. But I've talked to several members, and one threat that goes through the entire organization is that if you betray the organization, or if you don't help a member in a particular situation, if you don't give preference to a fellow Skull and Bonesman in a business or a political situation, they take that as a betrayal, and your all of your descendants are legitimate targets for recruitment or retaliation of some sort.
Yeah, and this was her firstborn son.
Okay, so this woman, and you know, my heart goes out to her, and if she'd like to contact me anonymously, you know, I'd be happy to email her back and forth.
Thank you, I'd appreciate that.
Sure, but what she's talking about is absolutely true and absolutely legitimate. Now, I'm not saying she's a victim of the Skull and Bones, but there are, most satanic organizations have that same oath. If you have betrayed the organization, the Satanist organization, then your family can be held liable for it. And generationally, your great-grandson after you're dead can be held liable for it.
Now, see, she has talked to her father, okay, even though her mother and father are no longer together. She has found him, she has talked to him, trying to get information on this, but he refuses to tell her anything.
Okay, he doesn't deny it, he just refuses to talk about it.
Right.
Okay, that's another.
And he did at one point of time, you know, when the 7 years was up, you know, he did say, you know, this is how she knew about us, because her father did tell her.
Right.
And it said, you know, and or later told her, I don't know exactly what point of time he told her, but he told her that that's where all the money came from, the power, the prestige, everything came from. But then when the 7 years was up, he couldn't go through with, he conformed to Christianity. And
right.
So because of it, he couldn't turn around and do what they required him to do. And then they ended
his
up losing, then they lost everything, you know, instantly. It's like, as fast as they got it, they lost it just as quickly. But then she wanted to know more of what happened, who was involved, et cetera, et cetera.
And
to this day, even though she has told him about what has happened to her son, he still refuses to tell her.
Wow, that's another very common characteristic is people who are involved in these groups think if they reveal any more beyond that, it will just cause more problems, which is, in many cases it definitely does. There's a film I would recommend to this woman. It's called The Brotherhood of the Bell, which was made in the 1960s, and Glenn Ford is in it. And he plays a person who, like you're talking about, joined one of these organizations and was, you know, given the world on a silver platter, but later on determined that he couldn't go through fulfilling, that they asked him to do something which would have harmed a colleague of his.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they wanted him to discourage this person from taking a particular job, and to threaten him if he didn't do it, and he refused to do it. And there again, they stripped this man, Glenn Ford played the character, they stripped him of all his wealth and everything he had, and even, you know, went after family members.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they lost their jobs, you know, loans were called in.
But you would think that because he knows that this is what's happening to his grandson, he would do something to try to help him.
It's very, very odd because he let the cat out of the bag already, and generally speaking, this network is so big and so powerful that someone in this position would be afraid to reveal more information about whatever branch of this organization he is in.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, I can understand why this woman's father doesn't particularly want to reveal anymore. He probably thinks it would cause more trouble for his grandson, and to a certain extent he might be right.
Mm-hmm.
But in order to, you know, for this woman to help her son, you know, I would encourage him to, you know, lay all his cards on the table and let his daughter know the full extent of what he knows about the organization and what oaths he took, who some of the more prominent members are. They're usually bankers and all sorts of finance people.
Mm-hmm.
Out there. And I would suggest that he does lay his cards on the table. Although his motivation might be very good, he might think by doing so he would open up a can of worms which would make his grandson's life even worse. So they're kind of on a razor's edge there.
Yeah. See, like the grandson, what happened was, now the grandson was, well-liked in school, you know, and, you know, just an all-American boy, you know, happy, you know, and intelligent. And then one night he went to one of these, he went with a friend to one of these concerts. I can't remember which one it was, but one of those hard rock concerts.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And then he spent the night at a friend's place, or at that one friend's place. But for some reason, they decided to go for a walk, you know, and sit out on this mound area, you know, that where they'd been doing some construction. And it was just like, after that night, something, he was never was the same. He, the other boy won't talk about it at all, what happened. But anyhow, he ended up going into major depression, actually, and saying to his mother that his mother wasn't his real mother, that he knows that she's a replacement, that he's been taken down into the tunnels. He talks about the end of the world coming. He gets very aggressive, almost to the point where one time she woke up with him standing over her bed. Sometimes she's very frightened to even sleep because she's afraid he's going to kill her. She's had, you know, she's been forced to have him committed. All the churches around, you know, feel that he's demon-possessed, you know, so they don't want to really help. And she's been just kind of like working on her own. Sometimes he has good days and he'll be fine. And then all of a sudden, for no reason at all, something sets him off. And then he's just like, he goes back into like, he'll actually walk out of the house and disappear into the woods. Or he'll go camping and stay there for a long time, and you know, and just she doesn't know where he goes, you know, what he's doing when he's out there, you know.
And he sounds very much like a victim of mind control in that, you know, they could have, you say he has a normal day, well, they could give, even program him with different words or terms that might come on the TV that he might hear walking down the street, mm-hmm. you know, something a little unusual that would act as a trigger to bring out these more hostile feelings and such.
Yeah.
You know, it could be lyrics to songs. That's a very hard situation. I don't have a quick and easy answer to something that sophisticated of a problem.
Yeah.
However, what I would suggest...
But it is possible that he's mind-controlled.
And they're using
keywords to set him off.
From what you're telling me, that's what it sounds like to me. That's my opinion. I don't know all the details. But from the rough assessment you've given me, and I should also point out, I've heard a million stories like this before.
Yeah.
Okay, I've heard tons. I get emails, I get phone calls, I get people I meet at different things, and they tell me the same sort of scenario. I was involved with a Satanist group, or my father or relative was involved with a Satanic group. He did something to... you know, bring about disfavor on him and the family, and a whole, you know, a dam broke, and there was a whole horrible series of events. And a lot of the times you hear about erratic behavior, you hear about people, you know, going missing for days on end, and when they come back, they don't know where they've been or what happened.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
You know, you hear about, you know, bizarre mood swings, and... The basic scenario you just gave me is very common, and I've heard it many, many times.
And you know, the strange thing about it is, like, he'll be fine, but if he gets close to me, like if she drives up here, you know, he will not come into this center. Or if I go out there, he'll just clam right up and look straight, like he's afraid that I might see something in him.
Well, sure. They will. People in that situation would tend to avoid anybody who would sort of reveal what's going on. That would be another program that would have been put into a person like this. Now,
she also said that, like a priest, she had a priest show up one day, and he was fine. Okay, and he talked fine to the priest and everything. But as soon as he left, she says he just flipped right out.
The trigger could be a Roman caller.
Well, I think what it could be, or it could be that anyone that may be trying to help him, somehow it could, you know, that may have the answer, could maybe there's some sort of a warning thing to stay away from certain people.
Well, sure. That's definitely part of it. And what I will do is I will send you information you can send to this woman. And she's, as I said, she's welcome to email me. There's a group here in Massachusetts called SMART that deals with a lot of the very things you're talking about.
Uh-huh.
You know, generational type things. I've spoken to the guy who runs it, and I actually went to one of their conferences once. And there again, you know, it's like a two-day conference. You hear this same scenario that you're talking about over and over and over again. So tell this woman she's not alone in having these sorts of experiences,
mm-hmm.
which that in and of itself might bring her some relief.
Yeah.
You know, and if she contacts SMART, this other organization, they would have far more informed strategies on how to deal with this situation than I could ever possibly give her.
Uh-huh.
And this referral to the SMART organization, which is based here in Massachusetts, it's right near the Rhode Island border, they could really give her better guidelines on how to deal with all aspects of this.
Well, she brought up an interesting fact, and she said to me, she says, you know, because she watches her son, because like I said, some days he's perfectly normal. She says, I got my son back. And then something will happen, and it just, whatever, will just set him right off. And it's almost to the point where she can't leave her children or her other children with him because she's afraid. You know, one time she actually saw him sitting outdoors, or her son turned around and came, her other son came in and told her, she said, Mom, come out here. And he was sitting outdoors with their pet dog with a
wow.
knife, and he was going to cut the dog's throat. And she said, what are you doing? And he says, I have to sacrifice him.
Okay, this is what you're telling me there again. It sounds like stories I heard from this SMART conference. And the SMART organization actually sells very inexpensive tapes of their yearly conferences that they have. And she could hear, you know, dozens if not hundreds of similar stories to what you just said. Okay, that there's dozens and dozens of other people who are having similar experiences as this woman is having. You know, it's not as uncommon as you might think.
Well, now what she went on to tell me was she says, now, Mary, she says, think about this. She says, my son will be, you know, fine, and then all of a sudden that'll happen for no reason at all. She says, just think about how many people in the Burlington area or in southeastern Wisconsin could be having perfectly normal lives, and then turning around and having a night or a day life normal, and then a night life that they can't remember.
Very common. These amnesic barriers, very, very common things. You know, and I think the biggest way that we could help this woman is, first of all, let her know that she's not alone in this, that there are other people with the exact same experiences that she is having.
Uh-huh.
And we could work to get her in contact with these people who, as I said earlier, have far better informed strategies on how to deal with all of this, including some therapists who actually work with people like her son.
Uh-huh.
You know, and we'll treat them sympathetically and not, you know, just ridicule what everyone has to say, but people who are there to help.
Uh-huh.
You know, and the SMART organization would be the good jumping off point for her to get out of all this. There is hope for her, and uh-huh. there is hope for her son.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want to help.
But would she have to get out of this entire area, though?
Not really, because there's nowhere you can go to avoid this.
Uh-huh. Okay, let me, I'm going to do an audio. Hi, Bob. How are you? Now, you were saying?
We can get this woman some support. Primarily from other people who are having the same experiences as her son was having. And we can, I also want her to know that there's certainly hope for her and her son, and that you don't have to relocate or go anywhere. There's a lot you can do over the net. There's a lot you can do over the telephone. There are people out there who understand this situation and will treat her sympathetically.
Uh-huh.
You know, if you were to go to a health clinician at your average hospital, you know, a psychiatric social worker or a psychiatrist or psychologist, they would pretty much see the mother and son and father as being delusional.
Uh-huh.
But there are other therapists who accept what is happening to her and people like her as a matter of fact, because they have dealt with a lot of people who are in the same boat. And again, the organization is called SMART.
Okay.
And it's online. I'm going to put a link up to it on my webpage on williamhkennedy.com. It will be in the link section. I'm going to put the smart link up tonight. This is a good time for me to do it. I've been putting it off, just busy with other things. But she can find the link on my page, and I will send you information. But tell anyone you meet in this situation that there is hope for them, and there are people who have recovered from this particular sort of mind control.
And and send me private email your telephone number so that I can give it to her.
Okay. Sure, I'll be happy to speak with her, and we can do that now.
Okay.
I have to get back to work. I'm editing the Satanic Crime book now, and I'm going over it with a proofreader and copy editor. So I certainly enjoyed being on the show, and I'll be glad to come back. And any referrals to people you have in this woman's situation, I'll be happy to send them to people that can help them. And I'd certainly like to thank you for having me back on the show.
Well, we always enjoy it. And I always thank you so much for keeping us updated on that abuse in the church section, you know, so that we're on, you know, we keep a hands-on, you know, to help these people that are out there. Because, you know, like with us, we're not just UFO and paranormal. We're into just about everything, ancient mysteries, religion, spirituality, as well as, you know, counseling, helping people, you know, that are out there that got a problem that can't be handled by the mainstream.
Conventional means.
Yeah,
sure.
Conventional means. So, anyhow, we're talking to, we're going to be talking, let's see, what do we want to, we want to go, first of all, before we leave, I want to go back and talk, just bring up your book really quick, that one that you have out now, all right?
Lucifer's Law, Satanic Ritual Abuse in the Catholic Church.
Right, and you got a link right on your site, right, that they can go to?
Yeah, they can go williamhkennedy.com, and they can buy it either directly from the publisher off of my website there, or from amazon.com. But, you know, I'd appreciate it if people would buy it directly from the publisher, because that sends more money to the publisher's way and my way. Amazon.com takes a big chunk for allowing they take like a huge chunk.
Yeah.
So I'd appreciate it if people would buy it through the link that's to the publisher as opposed to Amazon.com.
All righty, sounds good. And again, we're talking to William Kennedy, author of Lucifer's Lodge. And your new book's going to be out when? And what's the name of your new book?
The name of the new book is called Satanic Crime, A Threat in the New Millennium, and it's going to be put out by Dragon Key Press, and it should be out mid-April, early May latest. As I say, I'm just putting some final information in it, but that will be a survey of satanic crime from the 60s up till now. And I've done some, I have a chapter on Charles Manson, and like I interviewed Vincent Bugliosi, who prosecuted and sent Manson to jail. Just, you know, I have an exclusive interview with him and things like that. So it's a very up-to-date and informative book, which I know your listeners would enjoy.
Great. And if you ever get a chance, send us Lucifer's Lodge for our research library.
I will. I got to get another batch of them in, and I will donate a copy to BUFO.
Okay, thank you.
Burlington.
Yeah, because we have a regular library here for people to use. So, you know, and then if anybody wants to order the book, then they can just see what we have.
I'll make a note of it,
order.
And I will get you a copy for the public.
Okay, great. Okay, and again, thank you so much, William Kennedy. William H. Kennedy.com.